Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat. I'm Will Vincent, joined as always by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And today we are joined by Russell Keith McGee, who has a huge imprint in the Django community, and we're thrilled to have him on. Hello, Russell.
Hi, nice to have you. Thanks for having me.
So there's a lot of things we want to talk about today, but if you can give the 30-second version of how did you get involved with Django and put the exclamation points on all the ways you've been involved, because you've been involved, what, 12, 13 years? I mean, you're one of the very, very... the elders of the community.
Yes. We stroke my beard as I say
in a positive sense. In a positive sense.
So I joined the project. I wasn't involved at the Journal World. I was one of the first, or one of the early contributors who joined the project. I downloaded it for the first time around November of 2005, where it was about the 0.90, 0.91 timeframe. At that point in time, it was a period where there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. Like it was there and it was being used, but there was a lot of stuff that could be improved. And because it was Python, I could jump in and I could read the code and was able to work out what was going on. One of the first big contributions I made was around many-to-many fields. So if you've got your models, you've got a many-to-many field where A is related to B. Django, as of that time, you could query from A onto model B, but you couldn't query from B back onto model A. That was kind of useful. And so I thought maybe I want to be able to do that. I jumped into the code. It was basically take all the code that was there for one, copy it, reverse the direction of all of the variable joining order that was happening, and submitted that as a pull request. And after that and a couple of other little smaller pull requests that I had that I put together because I was just kind of tinkering and this looked interesting and I had some grand plans of things I was going to do, Adrian mailed me early January 2006 and said, hey, do you want to join the project? Now, at that time, what we were doing was a thing called magic removal, which is this very large-scale rewrite, which was only going to take 6 months, and 1.0 would be like weeks away as soon as we could finish magic removal. Magic removal was finished in about 6 months, and 1.0 took about another 2.5 years. But I was there through that process and was involved in the introduction of the user-facing testing tools for Django. I mentored a couple of students doing Summer of Code projects, most notably Alex Gaynor and the introduction of multiple database support, and a number of other little projects along the way over the course of a couple of years.
And you were in Australia this whole time, right? Just because we like to tap upon the global nature. Were you doing your PhD, or did you come out of your PhD program?
No, I was well out of PhD at that point. I finished my PhD in 2001 and was working for a defence consulting company. Western Australia, and Perth in particular, has a very large naval base, and there's a big sort of US naval presence, and defence consulting is a thing. And so I was working for them, and we just happened to have a project at about the same time that I discovered Django. Like, I was looking at Django for my own background tinkering side project stuff. And we happened to have a project where the project plan, we'd been funded to build this thing. We were going to build this giant Java client server application with databases and user interfaces and all sorts of things. And I sort of had this sudden realization in about February of 2006 that we're proposing to build a website, except it's going to be a lot more complicated and a lot harder to build. So why don't we just build it as a website? Like, it was a data gathering site for, like, the idea was that you're going to have assessors, teachers, trainers in a military simulation context, looking over students who were, you know, operating radars or flying flight simulators and assessing that they were identifying, targets as they were approaching, or whatever they had to do. They met their criteria for training. And they were just going to be like checkboxing, yes, they met this criteria, comment, they could have done it a little bit better, or whatever. And it is literally just filling in forms, which is exactly what the web is good for. So why don't we just build the form in Django and say it's done? And I pitched this to my immediate supervisor. I've been fiddling with this thing called Django. I've got a feeling we could knock this project out in like about 2 weeks if we just did it as a website rather than build this whole client server thing. And he went off and spent a couple of days and came back and said, we can do this. And we had like first prototypes up in a couple of weeks, and we polished it extensively beyond that. And it became a major line of revenue for the company beyond that. But that, because it was because I was discovering an open source project at its early phases, I had got myself embedded as a member of the core team, and then I managed to work out that I could use Django for my day job. It sort of became a self-fulfilling prophecy that I then had a reason to work on Django and was getting not paid to work on Django, but at least paid to address some of the bugs. And they didn't mind if I answered questions on the mailing list during work hours. So it kind of meant that there was a reason to stay involved as well.
Right. And that third piece is not always common. I mean, some of our guests who are very involved, have to code in not Django during the day.
Yeah, no, I was very, very lucky in that regard that I was working for a relatively small company that had certain liberties in the way they're implementing things. They didn't have to adhere to, you know, this huge spec that had been laid down by some huge contractor years before, and a engineering manager who was open to the idea of trying something new in the name of getting something done well, so done quickly.
It does also work the other way. And if I think of some of the major contributors currently who, you know, they're there all the time, it's because they're working with Django in day job and have that time. You know, people wonder how is it possible to contribute? Because, you know, it looks like these people are giving out a lot of time, and they are. But, you know, they have that opportunity.
Yeah, so. And that is, I suppose, ultimately is the thing, is that, you know, money ultimately is what decides what people's attention gets spent on. Now, there is an extent to which the work that I do in open source, like outside of Django, in Django, everything else that I've done, is, you know, the way that I entertain myself of a Saturday morning. You know, some people do Sudoku puzzles. I fix bugs in Django, or I fix bugs in an open source project. And it is a fun intellectual exercise from that perspective. Particularly when you start getting to the really gnarly problems or the really hairy bugs or the, you know, rewriting the website, which everyone really wants to do, having someone paid to do it makes a huge difference. And having someone whose day job it is means that, you know, there is a reason to have this work be done, which is a big, you know, the incentive matters there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think particularly the ORM, like there's a couple of major contributors there who ongoing basis, if they weren't there, I think it would be really difficult for Django to continue, and we're just very fortunate that they're there and that they, because their work relies on it, they are able to give us that time.
Yeah, do you want to call them out by name, Carlton?
Well, Simon Cialetti's in particular, Nick Pope, Tom Forbes, I don't know what his work is, but he gives a lot. There's a group of half a dozen people who work around the ORM that without them, we'd really struggle to move forward. But with them, we are able to do that, and it's fantastic.
And that is true historically as well. Like if you cast back a few years, it was Anssi Karjalainen, a Finnish guy who was working through his PhD, who did a huge amount of work in the sort of the 1.1 to 1.4-ish kind of time frame, if I remember rightly. And then even back before that, the reason we have the ORM we have is almost entirely because Malcolm Tredinnick, who sadly isn't with us and died a few years ago, spent 6 months almost on his own time. He spent a lot of time working for banks, being paid very well to work for banks, and then salvaged his, what was left of his sense of contributing to the community by going and contributing to open source projects like GNOME and Django. And the ORM we have is almost entirely his original design, like, yes, has been massively improved since, but the frameworks, the bones of what is there, is all Malcolm's work, and was done in like a period of about 6 months after about three or four rewrites. And I think at one point I have a recollection of a conversation with him where, like, he had a big contract where someone didn't pay him, and like, because he wasn't getting paid, all of a sudden, oh crap, I'm like on, I have no savings left because I've spent a lot of money contributing my own savings to Django instead of getting the next contract and padding my wallet. So
yeah, well, difficult, hey.
Perhaps that's a segue. You've spoken on a number of topics, but one of them is talking about, I mean, PyCon Australia 2015, money was the title of talking about how to make open source sustainable. I don't want you to repeat yourself, but where are you at with your thinking on that in 2019?
I don't know that I have any more answers, which is the unfortunate part of it. Like, there are a lot of little things that can work. I think there are still some... I think the problem we've got is that there are lots of ways that we can make a little bit of money. Also, to be clear, when I'm talking about a little bit of money, I'm talking about money that is sort of less than one full-time employee. I am mm-hmm. able to make a little bit of money through things like GitHub contributors and other forms of small scale fundraising. It is very welcome. I'm very glad, very, very grateful to the people who do sponsor me, but I'm not quitting my day job anytime soon on the basis of that, of the fundraising that I've currently been able to do available. And I have a very high profile, a very large microphone and frequent opportunities to use it. And I still can't crack getting people to donate to make things happen. So we have lots of mechanisms of making a little bit of money, but the large amounts of money you need to be able to hire multiple people, to be able to hire three or four engineers, is remarkably difficult to shake out. And the problem that I'm seeing is that we haven't worked out how to operationalize the fundraising process. The altruism is clearly not enough to make it happen. The fact that Django is valuable is, I don't think anybody who uses it or anyone who's in even the broader Python community who doesn't necessarily use Django, very few people would say it isn't a good thing that it exists. It isn't a good thing that Python exists. There is a huge amount of good that is being done with it. And it is good that you can get at it and it's free to get available. It doesn't cost you anything to download it. Django girls can use it without having to pay a tithe to some large corporation to be able to get access to the software. But that doesn't translate into large corporations that are making huge amounts of money through using Python, giving back into a format that is then that can then be operationalized and used by other by the groups that are maintaining the software that is being used. And to my mind, the key piece here is you need to find a way to express the ask in a way that businesses can put on their expense claims. Mm-hmm. I've had many conversations with people that have said, you know, I've got a corporate credit card. I can spend $1,000 a month without even raising a question on anyone's eyebrows. But I have to be able to say this was necessary for my work and I couldn't have gotten it cheaper elsewhere. And the core thing
is couldn't get it cheaper elsewhere.
When the price is zero, that's a problem. So yeah. Finding out yeah. what we can operationalize to get those funds out, I think is the piece that we haven't worked out yet. And I'm still searching for what that answer is.
Yeah, because there's things like the Tidelift subscription. Is that what it's called?
So Tidelift is one of them, there's a couple of those around. Tidelift is probably the one that's getting the most press at the moment. It is definitely interesting, and effectively what they're selling there is the support model of, you know, we will guarantee there is someone there to support your software.
I think it prioritizes the tickets, right? That's the idea. If you contribute, then of the 1,000 open tickets on Django, you could say, I really want this one done, Carlton.
It's not quite
that's
that
my
model,
sense.
Because they're saying that they will provide the resources to make sure that the issues that their subscribers have get resolved. And effectively,
right, they'll
that does
pay
make
the open source.
Yeah, yeah. They will pay the contributor to do that. One of the problems that exists with that is that it does work for a maintenance capacity. It works reasonably well for fix the bug that's there. It doesn't work well for funding work that large scale work that needs to be done. So I have actually spoken with the guys from Tidelift, and they're effectively not interested in doing anything to do with Beware because Beware doesn't have a user base yet. And so,
can you just mention what Beware is?
Beware is some of our listeners sort of project that I've taken on. I do less work in the Django community on a code basis. I'm still around, but I don't do as much in the code base. Beware is my attempt to get Python running on all the new devices that people have on iPhones, on Android tablets, on Android phones, in the web browser as a client language, and things like that, and provide the tools and resources to get Python into those spaces. It is still very much early days of that project. Like most of the tools are version 0.3, and even that is optimistic in some cases. And as a result, Beware doesn't have users. It doesn't have people who are using Beware to make money. They're not the cornerstone of the company, the .com that they're just, the startup that they're running. I'd like that to be where it ends up. But this is Django a year before it was publicly open sourced kind of space. There's still work to be done. There's a lot of work. There's resources that need to be spent. Tidelift isn't good for that model. It's only good for fixing bugs in things that people are actually using. And ironically, it almost works. The same problem almost hits when it gets to things like Django. Django is stable. Django is out there and is working. Yes, there are bugs, but they're not that common. Like, they're not in the, they still occur and there are still things being fixed and whatnot. But compared to the rate of change of bugs that were there 5-10 years ago, it's a lot lower. So
it's very stable now.
Yeah, it is very stable. So I suppose the theory is that you're going to pay Tidelift for this guarantee that bugs are going to get fixed, but which bugs and why? And like, why am I going to buy this support contract? Yes, there is absolutely a, you know, the covering of butt, making sure that it will be updated aspect that possibly will actually drive that. And it'll be interesting to see if Tidelift does manage to sell that broader narrative of, you know, insurance against the thing that should we hope never happens. Tidelift is definitely an interesting development. I have some reservations about the fact that it's a VC-funded company, which does sort of affects the economics of what they're doing. Like, they need to make a large amount of money out of this in order for it to be viable, not just for open source projects to be viable. However, I will take them on faith that they are doing what they are doing for good reasons, and we just have to shake out to see where that goes.
So another, I mean, because I think a lot about this, how to, the craziness, since I'm newer to it than you are, the craziness of how used and how much work people are putting into Django, and then you have these large companies that we can't align their self-interest with the projects. And again, I'm always curious about how decisions are made, you know, because it is sort of a consortium. I mean, for example, Django REST Framework, if you sponsor it, you have a prominent place on the documentation. That seems to me like an obvious way to get, you know, probably a developer's worth of salary on the Django site to do something similar. Because, I mean, I donate, a lot of people donate. If a company said, oh, for $1,000, you rotate through a place, because recruiting is a big issue for folks, right? Like, I wonder if I'm sure that discussion has come up. Where is to the extent you two know, the consensus on something like that? That seems like a very easy win to me from the outside.
So I can't speak to where the conversation is right now. I can speak to where it was a couple of years ago, because I went through a period being the DSF president. So I'm sure you did. there's two pieces to it. One is the reason it's problematic is that if you're dealing with that budget, you're essentially like the money that is spent on putting your logo on the website is either a marketing or recruiting budget, which is good money if you can get it, but very fickle and very prone to changing. We see that in conference sponsorships. Some years it is trivial to get conference sponsorships. You throw it out there, say there's a conference, and money just falls out of the sky. The next year, half the sponsors don't want to show up because priorities have changed in the way they want to spend their money, or revenues are tight this year because of, you know, global financial crisis or whatever, and all of a sudden marketing budgets are lower. So the money is highly flexible and is not tied to how much the software is being used. It's how much tied to how much benefit they think they can get through being prominently placed on this website, how much easier it can make their recruiting task.
Right. Well, they don't really have analytics on it per se.
Yeah. And the other side of it is literally it's the community pushback, or at least historically has been a community pushback to even putting analytics on the webpage because of in particular the European focus, like the GDPR data privacy type thing. There is concern about how much data we are gathering about our users and whether that information is going to be exploited, whether people have the right to use the software without being tracked, and so on. I can't speak to whether that is still currently a problem. I just know that there was a lot of pushback. There's one of the very early depths that Jacob Kaplan-Moss put together was around tracking, just putting into Django Start Project, tracking who, like putting in as an opt-out, We want to be able to log that you're using this just so we know how many people are using this and we can use this for recruiting purposes or fundraising purposes. And there was a huge pushback against that as a concept.
And the same with Homebrew, the Homebrew package manager for macOS. That had the same problem. They got, I don't know if they put it in the end or if they didn't put it in, but I remember there being a really big hoo-ha when there was a discussion about putting it in.
Yeah.
And it's difficult because it's this trade-off between needing to justify your existence and needing to say to companies, hey, we're worth your money, and then this whole open source free software thing where it's like, no, we don't want to track users. And for, you know, those are all good reasons too. Like,
but tracking users, right? I mean, Carlton, you must, maybe we can ask Tom when he comes on. I mean, it's I imagine it's a sizable amount of funding for DRF.
Yeah, so I will, I will say that DRF is probably the one success story that has, it has gone extraordinarily well for them. And, you know, mad props to Tom for everything that he's been able to do around that space. That, you know, he took a project
but still
that
on an ongoing basis, needing to re-find sponsors and redo it. And, you know, like, if you read the monthly reports that he puts out, he's very open on the funding situation for Encode. And it's not a done deal. It's not like he's got sustainable forever. It's like sustainable right now, but need to draw in more. And but he's doing amazing work.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's a conversation at DjangoCon. I'm happy to be a bull in a china shop on this because I have no past scars. But it seems I would like Django. I would like Carlton and Marius and others to get paid. Andrew for the async work, and it's such a hassle for these talented people at free or a discount to do it. And I don't think the community realizes the problem, right? Because it's not their problem. And if there are these solutions out there,
yeah, and it's part of the like the dilemma here is that if open source is working well, magic software falls from the sky that everyone can use, and you never have to think about how that sausage gets made, and yet it gets built because Andrew Godwin is effectively taking a huge pay cut to contribute some of his own time to work on this stuff. Now, I don't think necessarily that open source contributors should be making millions of dollars a year, but they certainly shouldn't have to be making a serious life decision about should I be in a position where I give up having a comfortable lifestyle so that large corporation with billions of dollars in the bank can make a little bit more money off of my efforts. And that's the part that really grates my gears.
Yeah. Well, we just this will come out probably a couple weeks from now, but we just released last week the interview with Andrew, which a lot of people have listened to, and we had hoped to be able to put a link into the funding around that and just the machinations of that. It's not available. So yeah, I think it's important for people to highlight to the community because these are real issues and some other, I'm always interested in how other frameworks do these things. I mean, for example, Laravel, PHP, is a one-man shop, and he's very open about, he sells, I think it's an e-commerce option for like $99, so consultants can use it, and you just download that and you have, boom, a SaaS product you can sell. He also has hosting. So there's a lot of, I try to find inspiration in other areas for how they do things. You know, Vue links to, it's Vue Mastery educational content where they give 5-10% or something of the sales of the educational product back to Vue. So yeah, I try to put my thinking cap on. I know other Django content creators, I've had this discussion with them. I mean, I would love Django to have a page of current educational resources and to get an affiliate fee, but I know that has been discussed to death and the community doesn't want to pick favorites. Is the Django view on that?
Yeah, that has been historically a push. The Laravel and the PHP, WordPress is another example that does it as well. Sort of, there's two levels at which these things operate. Like we were talking before about the fundraising coming from marketing and hiring, you know, recruiting budgets. The real goal is to get into someone's operational budget. You know, AWS is never going to not get paid, because if you don't pay them, they turn off your website. Their bill gets paid every month on time. That is the budget you want to be in on. Now, in the case of Laravel, they've got, now, here is a product we can sell that you can use. It is cheap enough that anyone can get access to it, but it's enough to make sure we can fund the rest of the development that's there. WordPress then takes it sort of a step further in generating the marketplace of saying, you know, this is where you can get your plugins. This is the place where you get all your stuff. And as a result of that, there is now, you know, there just as much as there are, this is how to build your WordPress website, there are training courses about this is how to build your company building WordPress plugins, because there is an expectation in the community that money will be part of the process, and there is a mechanism by which that money can change hands. And
it can be expense to the client, too.
And it can be expense to the client. Yeah, absolutely.
Because maybe we had Tom Dyson on with Wagtail. That would be a context where it would be easier to. Yeah, because my friends, they're just like, yeah, $99, whatever, expense it to the client, and it saves them $1,000 of time. But Django is a little more custom and advanced, typically, in how it's used.
Yeah, or at least the core of Django is, and there are two places where I can see this potentially, you could potentially get into the chain here. One is not saying put a paywall in front of PyPI, but at least put the ability so that you can charge in front of PyPI. So if I do want to release my package on PyPI, still be open source. But if you want to pip install it, you have to, you know, swipe the credit card and money goes through the till. That radically changes the dynamics of PyPI, and I'll completely grant that. But, yeah, you know, PyPI Pro is a mechanism. That is the operational point at which you get into someone's budget. The second one is one that I would love to be able to get in front of someone to propose this. And I'm hoping to be able to have some conversations at PyCon this coming weekend for me, and hopefully, you know, other conferences around the place, is to actually get to the AWS and the Googles and Google Clouds and the Azure people and say, okay, you know, all this software that you're putting up the platform. You are, in some cases, actually operationalizing open source software in the case of stuff like AWS. Can you put a check, if you are selling Microsoft, if you sell a Microsoft license for EC2, you buy a Microsoft license at your prorated rate of a Microsoft license. Can you put a checkbox in there that says that I'm using the open source license, charge an extra 0.5% of the money that's going through there, and then funnel that into open source foundations? Because that is a trivial box for any engineer to check. It is a bill that you can guarantee will get paid every month, and that money can then funnel into the community. Actually convincing the Microsofts and the Amazons and the Googles of the world to do that is a much harder sell, but I would love to see that kind of program in place, because that is the operational, that is where the money is. That is where the money is changing hands at volume. And if we can funnel even the smallest portion off of that, that would pay for all of the Django development we ever needed. It would pay for all the maintenance of the open source tooling that we ever needed.
And it's not just Django. I mean, this podcast is about Django, but it's not just Django. It's every little project out there. You know, it's all the third-party apps in the Django ecosystem, and it's all the packages on PyPI in the Python ecosystem, and then the same for the JavaScript world. And
Absolutely.
None of it's fun.
Well, and I love that the engineering mindset is to appeal to people's better nature, because perhaps because I have an MBA, fear works better, unfortunately, right? Like fear being like, hey, maybe Django won't be around. Hey, maybe, and finding a way to do it in not a blackmail kind of way. But that is the reality, right? I mean, if Andrew Godwin isn't able to be paid, even at this massive discount, async's not going to happen in 3.0, probably.
Yeah.
These stark terms. And I love that we're all thinking positive, but there are real costs, right? I mean, before, that's why, I mean, actually, maybe you could talk about, I know you were actively involved. We had Tim Graham on the Django Fellows, kind of why that came about, and then how, right? Because it was two plus years between releases. And then part of Tim's work was to standardize that to the schedule we have now, right? I believe you played a big role in that.
I played a big role in getting the fellowship program going. That was one of my last hurrahs as I walked out the door of being DSF president. I think we did have a fairly regular release cadence. It was a much slower release cadence, and often
Tim
slipped
said
by
years
months
for
at a time.
One.
Yeah, it was. We did go 18 months or 2 years at one point. Yeah, but it was kind of more of a realizing that we were having this slow increase in the number of tickets that were being opened and they're not even really looked at. And there were patches that were being contributed and not reviewed. And they're like the DSF itself is an interesting legal structure. So it's a 501c3, which is a US not-for-profit foundation. The US tax office doesn't consider software development to be a charitable activity, which is a problem when you're a software-based foundation. So the DSF, there's a number of things the DSF can't do, and one of them is we can't hire someone to write software. So I shouldn't say we. The DSF can't hire someone to write software. If you look at the terms of which Carlton and Tim and Marius are employed, they are there as community managers. The community management process inevitably involves some writing of software, but they are there managing the ticket process, making sure the wheels are greased, that everybody's contributions are actually happening. The DSF actively paying for Andrew to work on something gets into very, very weird territory. And I won't profess to speak to where that discussion currently is or anything like that in terms of the DSF, but I am aware that those issues exist, even to the tune of there's been some recent discussions about paying members of the DSF board for the roles they're doing. Like, you know, the person doing the accounting, which absolutely has to be done right and has to be done on time, but also gets very weird if you pay them because of the way the 501c3 operates. Anyway, that's getting deep into the weeds.
No, that's interesting context, because I didn't know that. I just asked Andrew and he vaguely referred to issues. So perhaps a transition. So you're wearing a DjangoCon sweatshirt that people can't see, but DjangoCons, I've heard some stories of...
I'm surprised it's bright pink.
So pink it comes over the audio.
Maybe, yes. When did you... You were at the first DjangoCon, right? Because I've heard stories of you giving multiple talks in the early days when you couldn't get enough speakers. And I guess, how have you seen DjangoCons advance over time to where the San Diego one's coming up in the US this fall?
Yeah, well, we say there's another one before then. There is DjangoCon Australia, yes, happening in just 2 days.
That's right.
So yeah. I have been to every single DjangoCon except two. So I missed the very, very first DjangoCon Europe in Prague, and I missed 2013 in Zurich. But I've been to every DjangoCon US, I've been to every DjangoCon Australia, most of them because I was organizing them, and I've been to all bar two of the DjangoCon Europes. That's quite a
commitment.
Yeah, and I tie that record with Andrew. Andrew has been to all the US and all the Europe, but has missed two PyCon Australia. So we're down to monkey knife fight for last man standing on who's gonna take it.
Yeah, well, I saw he was tweeting about just landing in Sydney, so you guys will tie this coming one.
Yep, we're staying tied. It's whoever drops out first. It's been a ride. It is they have changed a lot over time. Like the very, very first DjangoCon US 2008 was essentially Django 1.0 was about to happen. Someone went to Jacob and Adrian and said, "Hey, how about we have a conference?" And they said, "Well, yeah, sure, as long as you organize it." they managed to arrange with Google for Google at the Mountain View campus to provide a space for 2 days. And they did all the AV recording and whatnot. And we called in a bunch of favors with friends and whatnot. We got Cal Henderson, who was one of the founders of Flickr, is now one of the founders of Slack, who did one of the opening keynotes, which is still to this day one of my favorite keynotes of all time. Well worth going back and watching. And it also set an interesting theme that ran for a couple of years. The talk is called Why I Hate Django. And it was basically Cal Henderson, as a person who builds a website or was responsible for a website that was several hundreds of orders of magnitude larger scale than anything Django was operating with, talking about why Django wouldn't scale to that level. And it was this combination of he's a very engaging speaker who had the entire of Flickr as his his slide deck image catalog, and amusing reasons. Like, we couldn't possibly use Django because it doesn't have a mascot, preferably a mascot with magical powers, which is where the Django pony
right,
ended
hence
coming
the
from,
Django pony
that
right yeah, yeah.
Like, after that comment. And then subsequently, well, see, the problem, one of the problems is that it doesn't do multiple database support, and multiple database read-write support is absolutely essential if you've got large traffic, because you have to be able to shard your reads across multiple sources. And at the time, it didn't. One by one, we've actually been hitting off most of his criticisms. I think I went back and audited them at one point, and we'd only missed two or three of them, and they were fairly edge case things that only Flickr needed or were of marginal utility. That was also set the tone, because for many PyCons after that, many DjangoCons after that, we had a habit of inviting someone to speak at DjangoCon as a keynote from a different language community to tell us what we were doing wrong. So you have someone from the Smalltalk community come and talk about why Smalltalk is better. You have someone come and talk from the Zope community come and talk about why Zope is better than
Ruby. Because
interestingly, we never managed to get David Hanson or anyone from the Ruby community that I can remember.
Right.
I just emailed him, actually blind emailed him yesterday to say, hey, you should come on our podcast, since he's on every other podcast.
Yeah.
And also David Lord about Flask. So I'm glad, yeah. I didn't know this was a thing, but I'm glad it is, because I think ultimately, 95, it's like, our DNA with chimpanzees, like 98% is the same. And then the differences are actually really helpful for both communities to discuss. Like Flask, Andrew was talking about in Flask, they're tied to WSGI. So they're going to have a, it's interesting to see how they'll adapt to an async world, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that shared DNA thing is absolutely a thing. Like Rails implementation of cross-site scripting, CSRF handling is almost, you know, mod the language changes and squinting is essentially the same approach, the same implementation. When we have had security reports against Django's CSRF handling, you send an email to the Rails guy to say, hey, by the way, you might want to just check to see if you're affected by this as well, because chances are you are. And you know, we've had a couple of those go back and forth of they find a bug and tell us, we find a bug and tell them. And yeah, it turns out we're both affected by the same bug and we do almost parallel security releases around the same problem.
Right. Well, I think that's because beginners see it as a competition and then people working on it see them as complementary tools. So I think that's an important distinction to make for people. Because I mean, I'm asked all the, as an educator of beginners all the time, Rails, Flask, this and that. And, you know, I want to say it doesn't matter, but I want to give advice to people, which is usually just pick one. Django's a great choice, but just pick one and get into it. And once you've learned one, you'll see the similarities between all the others and you'll be able to bounce around as needed.
Yeah, that's the thing. It is simultaneously the most important thing and the least important thing. It is the most important thing because it will literally be the thing you work on every day. So, you know, you pick a community you like and there's documentation is good and it seems to be healthy and progressing because you don't have to replace your code in 2 years' time. But once you've met that basic requirement, it honestly doesn't matter which one you pick as long as you are comfortable with your choice because you know, Ruby and Python, yeah, okay, there are significant differences, but the things that are there are more things that are similar than things that are different.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. What else? There's a lot of things we want to cover, so I'll jump to. So actually, one thing that I wanted to talk to you about. I think this is the first time I emailed you out of the blue and you responded about your talk on authentication, Red Blue User, because this is back when I was wrapping my head 2 years ago around the multiple user models in Django, and I remember. Yeah, it's like, why would you need a custom user model? And this is a great talk. We'll link to it. But you were giving the example of not everyone's name fits a first and last name paradigm, especially yours. And I know you and Andrew Pinkham have worked on Django Improved User Project, right? Which I've talked with him about. So maybe to tee that up, perhaps you could talk about, so why do this Django Improved User Project? How do you handle, I think the interesting question is, how do you deal with a legacy thing like the user model that's built into Django, yet there are these limitations that we want to make it forward-facing to, you know, match modern patterns?
Yeah, sure. So the work I did with Django Improved User is effectively the public-facing contribution of something that's very difficult to add into Django's core itself. Django 1.0 did what every website does. It sets up an internal user model that is first name, last name, and a password. And it turns out that is a serious anti-pattern, and it is one that it normally ended up hitting people, not because of that anti-pattern, but because people wanted to log in with an email address. And if you've got a username, first name, last name, and username is capped at 16 characters or something like that, you can't put an email address in it. And so people say, oh, but can't you just increase the length of that to 40 characters? No, it can't be 40 characters. How many characters do we have to make it to be able to allow it to accept an email address? And so on and so on. But even once you get past that problem, you then end up with, okay, well, but then you've got first name and last name, and not everybody has what you could reasonably call a first name and last name. You go to things like Chinese names, for example. Which name is the first name and which one is the last name when you say Mao Zedong? His given name is Dong, which is the name at the end of the list. But if he puts Mao, like if you put it in the order in which it's written, you're going to get it in the opposite order to which it is useful if you're thinking the last name is the one that's the family name. If you go to the third Secretary General of the United Nations, his name was Tant. That was his entire name. He only has one name. There is no first name, last name. His name is Tant. So what does he put in last name? Right. If you've got a lot of Islamic people, will have a sort of a pre-given name of Muhammad as an indication of piety. That is their first name, but it's not the name you'd ever call them. So there are a bunch of these problems that exist when you say first name and last name that aren't immediately obvious. And so I wanted to get in there and say, okay, yeah, we are baked in that we have an existing user model. We need to move off of that user. Django having its history of essentially not breaking anyone's code unless we absolutely have to means we need to find a way of migrating out of that. So that means we need to find a way to allow users to opt into a new user model such that they can then say, okay, now on this website I'm building, this new website I'm building, I'm going to use a better pattern for that. And the one of the better patterns that exists is sort of short name. What name do you want me to use, to a casual name, or what do you want to use me to refer to you as? If I write a letter to you, or do I say dear Will? What's the Will bit? That's that name. And then full name, how do you want me to address you when I send you the legal filings? You know, I want William H. Vincent or whatever, you know, the full name that's there. You're then capturing the role that you want the name to fill rather than some preconceived notion of there's always a first name and a last name. The problem is that, like, my original goal was to see if we could actually get that as a contrib module in Django itself, because there are, like, that short name, full name is a common enough pattern that at least, you know, people shouldn't have to reinvent the wheel over and over again. But it turns out there are some problems with that around testing, and the biggest problem around the swappable model thing that Django user models does is around migrations, because if you change the user model, like Django's migrations don't trace the state of the settings file. And you can change your user model by changing a setting. So you need to then have an audit trail for some of the settings in your configuration file, and hilarity ensues from there. That is ultimately the technical reason why it wasn't done. So the easiest way to manage that from a practicality perspective is let's have a completely standalone project that does it the right way and is tested and does all the things it needs to do and has all the integrations with all the things it needs to be integrated with and is being tested against recent versions of Django and so on and so on. But let's keep it external and deal with it that way.
Well, I remember tweeting with Tom Christie about this very issue when I was first wrapping my head around it. And I was saying, well, why can't we just default to a custom user model? Because that solves a lot of problems for people. And he suggested potentially you could do it with the start project command. Now, this adds complexity, but saying, you know, there's like advanced version where from the beginning you maybe, and then you could sort of stuff in all these other things that are legacy issues without breaking. But I know it's a tricky thing. And I love the beauty of just not having these issues on Django, but there are these general legacy questions. There's a number of things that would be nice to be addressed in a non-breaking way.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I think this issue that the start project template doesn't give you a custom user, and that yet the docs say you should have one. It's like, but I've started project, I've started code, I've created some models, and then I've come to read the docs in more depth, and oh no, I've done the wrong thing. And by then it's too late. And
yeah, but it's one of these. It's a complexity. It's a complexity you only know exists when it's too late to know it exists. And so then you've got to start your project again, which is kind of a bad user experience, but yeah, it's awkward. And one of these things that, you know, because it is just awkward enough and there is just enough of an easy enough way to work around it that no one sat down and spent the original contrib auth user getting that landed was like a 3-4 months worth of all of my open source contribution time just to get that landed, let alone all of the other problems that come with, you know, making sure there's an onboarding path that makes it easy to adopt the what should be the right thing when you come on board and things like that.
Speaking of onboarding, I'd love to have you talk about your PyCon speech from this year that I was able to sit in the audience for, where you spoke about the challenges around Python itself, around installing if you deal with any beginners, and then packaging. I wonder if you could give, how would you sum up that talk? Because we're going to link to it. It's an amazing talk, but it talks on some of these existential crises of, or potential issues around how does Python die? And this might be one of the ways.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was a weird one in that I was sort of standing up and being Cassandra talking about how the world was all, like, the Python world is going to die, which actually ultimately wasn't really the point of the talk. The point is that it can die if we don't pay attention to what is going on.
Yes. Yeah.
I heard a really interesting comment today. Someone pointed out that I think it was watching a talk from Lucas Langer from his keynote at Pylondinium, which was an awesome talk as well, mentioning that the rise of the AI and data science community coincided with a switch from Python 2 to Python 3. And that may have been what saved Python from the Python 2 to Python 3 transition. Because we had a sudden influx of new users just as we were adopting a new code base. And so they weren't coming with the hangover legacy of the old Python 2 code base.
Right.
And it's interesting to note that a lot of the uses where Python has historically had a lot of use in the web space, in system administration and whatnot, those groups are less common than they once were. Now, that doesn't mean it's the doom and gloom and the web's been seeded JavaScript and systems language, everyone's using Go for systems. But it is an interesting observation, if only because it means you have to look for where your next user is coming from. And there are a number of things that exist in the Python ecosystem at the moment that are not good for our next users. Our next users, the example I gave in my keynote is my son. My son started high school last year. He doesn't have a laptop. A lot of schools will have, everyone's got to have a computing device and they do all their high school work on computers. My son has an iPad. All of his educational experience is delivered through an iPad.
Yeah,
why is he going to learn Python? Yeah. Why is he going to learn Python? You can't, you can run Python in a simulated shell or something on a website, but you can't build an iPad app in Python. So why is he going to learn Python? Now, that doesn't mean it is, Python is still a good language to teach people to program in. But if you're faced with a teacher who's looking to optimize their education outcomes, the way they're going to do that is by exciting the kids to be able to do something practical with their device, the actual device they've got in their hand. If Python can't do that, we have a problem. Similarly, how do you, even outside of actually on a desktop machine, I write we're going to get a kid interested in writing code. They want to write a game. They want to give their game to their friend. Point me at the page of instructions where I can teach a 15-year-old who has just written their first game how to package their game to give it to their friend, which doesn't involve their friend also reading the same page of instructions about how to set up their Python environment, install all these dependencies and everything else they're going to go through. That's a problem. That user experience, one of the big areas where Django has where Django and Python have advantages is in this space of people who are not computer science geeks. They are people who are using computers as tools to get stuff done. And our tool chains don't well support that use case. You need to have a very deep understanding of environments before sandboxing and virtual environments makes any sense whatsoever. Once you understand it, it makes a reasonable degree of sense, but getting to that point is huge. And packaging that code to give it to someone else is a non-trivial activity there are no standardized answers for that, or not particularly good standardized answers for that at the moment. The perpetual bane of Django Girls workshops. You get a bunch of people into a room, you teach them how to use Django, you teach them how to build a website, which works fine on their local machine, and then you tell them we want to deploy it on any environment, be it Heroku, be it Python Anywhere, whatever. But Python Anywhere is a lot better than what it used to be when it was Heroku instructions. But deploying a Django website is not a one-button click thing. It is, you've got to get multiple configuration files and paths set up in the right place and configurations going in the right direction. And that is a lot more than most people are willing to put up with to just get a website up and running.
Well, yeah. You don't have to, but you should. I mean, I say that, so my Django for Beginners book, we, handful of steps, but I mean, we don't do all those things. So you get it up, it's not particularly secure. And but then, yeah, Django for Professionals, my new book, I have multiple chapters on just the bare, 80-20 minimum. And it's a lot of steps. And I think the challenge too for teaching is that people can use something like Django Cookie Cutter, which is fantastic and does a lot of these things, but you're not going to understand it if you just drop that into your tool chain. You kind of have to learn how to build it up yourself, which is, at least in that book, I spent a lot of time building up how to do that. But yeah, your point is directly accurate. I mean, Rails, Heroku was built for Rails. They did have one-click deploy. And that was sort of the Rails, was it Rails tutorial, I think. I modeled a lot of things on the Django for Beginners book saying we can get pretty close to that, actually. So the first chapter, we deploy Hello World, but there are a couple extra steps. I'm personally excited with containers. The deployments can be a lot easier. I mean, it is sort of like trusting that the image and everything works, but You know, for Django girls, I mean, I think about this with my Django X starter project. There is a degree of, should I add a Docker part where it's like, just trust that this works, and, you know, fixing it will be a lot more work, but you can get pretty close to a one-click deploy and then at least give people the confidence that it's, you know, I find the moment that someone can not just deploy it themselves, but I say, show it to someone else, that's when it really clicks. Yeah. And, oh, yeah. Now we can add Google Analytics, and you can prove and you can see that they actually did it. For beginners, you know, that's sort of like the face in the New York Times website. You know, it's like these like booms in people's head around what you can do.
Yeah, no, and I agree. Like you compare it to like the deployment experience of PHP is copy a file with FTP to your website and your website is up. So, you know, that's what we're competing against in terms of degrees of simplicity. I agree, like the Docker experience, you know, other than the fact you have to sort of download the universe before it works for the first time. The containerized model is definitely very interesting, and seeing that sort of evolve into more tutorials is definitely something that's interesting. But then you're also right in that having a cookie cutter that spools out thousands of lines of code, which is all boilerplate, and you're trying to work out what that boilerplate does. I had to play around with Falcon, which is a web framework that's asynchronous by default. That was delightfully refreshing getting going. Like, it is literally three lines of code and you have a web server type territory. No, there's a lot of stuff, like this is the classic Flask versus Django thing. There is a lot of stuff you don't get, but the simple stuff worked so quickly that it's compelling. And that zero to kick ass time, that time it takes you to go from I know nothing about this to doing something useful that I can see is applicable to my personal situation, and I understand what it was that I did. It wasn't just me copying and pasting this 100 lines of code and hoping I understood that it did what I meant it to do. That's a powerful thing, and often overlooked.
Yeah, well, I think that's possible with Django. I mean, if you Google like Django Hello World, I believe I have the top hit for that, because you can really do it in just a couple lines of code, which I think if you're an expert, you sort of, you know, go, oh, that's not correct. It's like, well, it's enough. At the same time, I think, you know, cookie cutter, like I've learned so much studying that project, but certainly when I was starting out, I was just, what is going on here? And so a long-term goal for me is, I kind of laid it out in the book, and once I've my Django X project, I'm going to basically say, here's this project, and if you want to know how I built it step by step, the book will show you, just because there are so many steps. And again, you have to make some opinions as a educator or as a designer, but opinions are better than sort of going, well, it depends, which Carlton and I joke is the tagline of this show.
Well, yeah, it depends, as every episode. But like, I think it's like you mentioned, oh, with Docker, it can be easy one-step deploys. Well, yeah, I've got a one-step deploy, but I've got years of putting together playbooks to make that deploy happen.
But can you share it, Carlton?
For
right?
new users,
can you share it though?
Yeah, it's, well, more or less templatable and shareable, and yeah, and you give it to clients, and you know, but that knowledge isn't something you can expect a kid picking up a Chromebook to have. They've got to have a much smoother story than that. Otherwise, but you know, I look at Mac apps or Windows apps. It's not a trivial process to package one of those. If you build a Mac OS app with Xcode, and okay, once you've got the final executable, but to get that executable is really quite difficult.
I think the answer, which I find exciting, is these web-based containerized programming platforms like Replit,
Glitter.
What is it?
Glitch.
Yeah, Glitch, they're all doing the same thing. I mean, if you're a teacher, a lot of times, you need a way, you can automate testing, and students don't have to have their own laptops, so they can have any computer. You know, in some ways, I wonder if that will solve some of these issues, because it's all just in the cloud. The problem there is the business model, which is it's hard to get money from students, and at some point you want to eject and go to the real thing. Sort of the challenge I think Python Anywhere and Heroku and others have is people eject at a certain point. Anyways, well, we're coming up on time. We've thrown a lot of questions at you. Are there any projects or things you want to highlight, Russell, before we head out?
Oh, well, they're throwing me on the spot there. Like, I am very excited to see what Andrew has to say this Friday. He's talking about it about async and sort of where that's going. That is for me one of the big unanswered questions of how Django moves to the next level. Django is what it is, and it is great at what it is, and it will say that, you know, it does more than enough for plenty of people. But you know, async is a thing; it exists, and there are things you can do or do more of, increasing the lifespan of Django if that's better supported. The other end is like the, and this is, it plays a little bit into Beware, it plays a little bit into things like Wagtail, is the front end story. Like I very badly would like to see a much less JavaScript, much more Python front end story, and I don't know that I have any good answers. Like I can't point at anything there. What Beware is doing is kind of part of that big picture. Seeing that, you know, there is Wagtail is there, and is, you are able to build rich widgets and rich containers and rich experiences through things like Wagtail is certainly interesting. I don't think either of those projects are by themselves the end of the story. Like there, I think there is an opportunity here to reclaim some of what the ground that Python has ceded in the web space to JavaScript as a client, the front end, through things like better use of technologies like WASM, WebAssembly. But that is a much longer project, and one that is going to take eyeballs and attention, and who's going to spend the time to build the thing and then open source it so that we can all use it is the...
Can I ask about WebAssembly? Like, do we have currently the ability to, for instance, script the DOM there?
Because... Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely. So like if you go to Pyodide, Mozilla has been playing with this with Pyodide. If you go to the Pyodide sort of the demonstration page, that is effectively a Jupyter notebook running entirely in your browser. So it's, you know, right. full C Python, full NumPy, full SciPy, full Matplotlib, all compiled to run in your browser. So there's not a Jupyter kernel running that your web browser is talking to, like the normal sort of Jupyter model. It is all running in the browser as WASM, as WebAssembly. And it is literally just the C Python sources and the SciPy sources and the NumPy sources compiled into WebAssembly. The downside is that it's a little bit big. Like it's about 12 megabyte, I think, like the full payload download, which is
quite a lot on a page load.
It's fine if you're downloading a Jupyter notebook that you're going to use once, or like load once and then use persistently. It's not if you want your homepage of your website to be that.
Yeah, I was thinking like a sort of jQuery, but using Python, you know, so you're actually scripting the DOM and doing, so you, instead of having an HTML file, a CSS file and a JavaScript file, you'd have a HTML file, a CSS file and a Python file.
Yeah, it is entirely in the realms of the possible. And that is kind of what I have been playing around with Batavia. Batavia's not doing it with WebAssembly, although I have some thoughts about how that might progress. It is entirely possible. You can, from within WASM, access the DOM, and there are multiple channels by which you can get to that. There are some garbage collection issues you kind of need to dance around a little bit, but you can certainly do it. And I have had, at one point in the not-too-distant past, a demonstrator of like one of the talks that I gave at PyCon Australia 2 years ago, I think, was a demo where in the space of 17 minutes, I took one Python file, one Python application, deployed it as a native Mac app, a native Windows app, a native GTK Linux app, a native iOS app, native Android app, and as a single page web app. And it was only a Fahrenheit to Celsius converter. But in every one of those steps, there was nothing other than the 40 lines of Python just deployed in different ways, and it would work natively on all those platforms. So it can be done.
Yeah, and that would be awesome because that's kind of the missing thing. I can use Python for analyzing data frames. I can use it for scripting system administration tasks. I can use it for building a website. But if I could somehow build a GUI on front of that for a native app, that would be brilliant.
And some of it is story. Actually, it's part of the reason why, like, well, at least to my mind, part of the reason why Node has become such a big thing is that JavaScript is the language that's in the client. There are occasions where you have logic that needs to exist in the client and needs to exist in the server. You know, if you've got like a credit card validation algorithm or something, it needs to run client side and server side. If I have to write it in JavaScript in the client side, then why shouldn't I write it? Like, why should I just use the same implementation? Why should I have to re-implement it on the back end? But if we can push it the other way, that's incredibly powerful.
Right. Especially as JavaScript is becoming more Pythonic over time anyways. Even if it's syntactical.
Again, coming back to the fact that, you know, all the ideas, there's only half a dozen ideas and we all just keep stealing off each other as time goes by.
Good artists borrow, great artists steal, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Oh, well, there you are.
Thank you so much for coming on. and sharing your story with the community. And we'll have links to everything so people can check out your work. If people want to get in touch, what's the best way? I mean, obviously, give you a fun beware. We'll get your attention, but how else can people get in touch?
So yeah, I'm Freakboy3742 on almost every platform. So on Twitter, on GitHub, all those. You can get me through the Beware project. There, beware.org is sort of the hub of all the work that I'm doing in open source at the moment around getting Python running on all these platforms. You can, and in terms of funding that work, you know, I am always on the lookout for people who can either help me pay for that development work, contribute to that development work, any ideas about how to commercialize that development work. I still haven't completely given up hope of finding some way of making Beware a commercially viable project. I just need to kind of find the person to be the business end of that. And because I can talk business, but I'm not good at it. Either way, so you can, if in the meantime, you can sponsor me through the Beware project, the beware.org, or you can sponsor me through GitHub sponsors. I'm on that program as well.
Super.
Great. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right.
Take care.
Bye.